Since 1960, the city of Milwaukee has elected only three different mayors. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Kate Archer Kent. And next Tuesday, the city will elect its fourth mayor in more than 60 years after Tom Barrett resigned to become President Biden's ambassador to Luxembourg. While we are working to have both of the candidates for Milwaukee mayor join us again before next Tuesday's election, only Cavalier Johnson is available this morning, and he's here to answer your questions over this next half hour. So what do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize, and what are the city's biggest challenges ahead as you see them? Ask your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Get your emails in now, ideas@wpr.org. Cavalier Johnson, candidate for Milwaukee mayor, currently acting mayor, president of the Milwaukee Common Council, and a District 2 alder. He became interim mayor after the Milwaukee after Tom Barrett resigned. Chevy, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
I appreciate you being here this morning. Thank you for your time. And I just want to start, since you've been acting mayor since the beginning of the year, I would be interested in knowing, if you were to be elected next Tuesday, is what you've done over this these last few months what we can expect going forward? And how would you lay out your leadership so far in the mayor's office?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the question. Over the course of the next 2 years, the remainder of the former mayor's term that I'm vying for in the April 5th election, we'll continue to implement the strategies that I've laid out for Milwaukee's future in terms of safety, in terms of reducing reckless driving, in terms of growing economic prosperity opportunities for the residents here in the city of Milwaukee. That's what this campaign has been all about for me, is making a city that is stronger, that is safer, and that's more prosperous for everybody. So we'll continue to work on exactly that.
Well, Milwaukee just had its second year of record-setting murders. How can you, as mayor, address violent crime in the city?
Well, there's a number of things that I think we can do, because I believe that public safety needs to be holistic. Police are part of the public safety infrastructure in Milwaukee, as it is in, you know, virtually every other major city across the country, and they're valuable, and we should have them. But if you talk to police officers, they'll tell you that they can't do the job alone. And so we need holistic public safety, and that's exactly what I want to bring to Milwaukee. So I want to have the adequate number of police, most certainly, but I think it's also important to make sure we have earlier interventions in the lives of young people. I think it's important that we have mental health services, that we have violence prevention, and that we provide stability in the lives of the people who live in our city, because that'll create stability in those neighborhoods and help us get to the point where our neighborhoods can gel, become cohesive, and that's how you get to true public safety.
Yeah. So, Chevy, what would that mean for the people in your city? If there was somebody with a mental health crisis, would there be somebody other than Milwaukee police officers who would show up at the scene? Are there alternatives to intervention as you see it going forward? And could you find a way to make that part of, you know, the process in Milwaukee?
Yes, there is. And I know that a number of other communities are exploring ways to do this. In Milwaukee, we've been working at, I certainly have, and have worked to expand upon what are called these CART teams, or crisis assessment response teams, so that if there's an individual who has a mental health concern, they're not approached solely by somebody with a badge and a gun. They're approached as well by somebody who's a clinician, somebody who's got some expertise in mental health care, because not every incident that somebody's going through requires somebody who has arrest powers. You know, sometimes they need, you know, a different approach. And so we've worked to implement that in Milwaukee and expand upon that in Milwaukee as well. Just a few short weeks or months ago, it's all a blur right now, but the county, Milwaukee County, worked to build, they're constructing it right now, it'll soon open, right in the city of Milwaukee, not out in one of our suburbs in the county, far away from the population that needs it, a mental health emergency center. And it's something that I was present at, spoke at, and supportive of. So we bring those resources closer to home, closer to the people that need them. So that's what we'll be doing. We will be working to make sure that there's accessibility to the people who need those sort of services in the city of Milwaukee.
Chevy Johnson, our guest, candidate for Milwaukee mayor in the Tuesday, April 5th runoff election, and your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Chevy, you were at the scene of the triple homicide over the weekend at 54th and Mill, and if that wasn't in your Alder district, it was right there around the north side. You've seen a number of these now, and you've been to these scenes, and you tell me what it's like to walk up to a place where people are grieving and you know, and you're a leader of this city.
Yeah, you know, when I went this this past Sunday to the scene, it actually knocked me off schedule because I was to go to Employ Milwaukee to talk about bringing on a whole host of summer youth jobs for young people in Milwaukee. You know, that's part of our plan for economic prosperity and making sure that young people are engaged. But instead, I had to detour and go to that. And when I got there, there were mothers, there were aunts, there were cousins, other family members. And the look that I saw in their eyes was grief. Their body language said that they were numb. And it's because, you know, too often in this community, we've got individuals who have too easy access to firearms who shouldn't have them in the first place, quite frankly. And when they do get that access, they use it for deadly results like the ones that we saw just on Sunday. And so, you know, I told them, just like I've been saying this campaign, it's so critically important that we improve the relationship between the city of Milwaukee and the state government, because at the local level, you know, we don't control gun law. We respond to it, and our police department does a great job of pulling guns off of the street. But there's this tide, this flow of guns that we need to make sure that there are some common sense reforms in place so that folks who would cause this sort of death, harm, and destruction in our community don't have the tools to carry that out. But we need partnerships with the state in order to make that happen. And that's exactly what I'll be doing. I said that I'd have a cot in the Capitol, working on issues important to the city every single day, and I'm serious about it.
Chevy Johnson would put a cot in the Capitol were he to be elected. And he's joining us and answering your questions, if you have any, on the heels of what is to be the runoff election next Tuesday for the next mayor of Milwaukee. 1-800-642-1234 to join us. Chevy, there are 86 road fatalities in Milwaukee County just last year. Speed was a factor in 36 of those, but the underlying concern is reckless driving. And I know some intersections have been addressed already. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel ran an article just yesterday, I think, about Water and Van Buren streets becoming more friendly for bikes and walkers. What can we do about reckless driving? And is there a bigger picture here that we're looking at when it comes to public safety?
Yeah, that is certainly a part of the public safety problem that we have in Milwaukee. And I know that it's a growing problem in other communities across the United States. I was hearing some stories recently from elected officials in Madison, as well as in Racine, about the issue as well, and Green Bay too. So the problems are real in cities in Wisconsin, as well as cities across the country. I'm glad you mentioned the article the other day in the Journal Sentinel, and it mentioned that it's implementing, you know, some of the strategies that my administration has put forward. Some of the things that I, as a candidate for mayor and the sitting mayor, want to see happen in Milwaukee. That's implementing my comprehensive plan on addressing reckless driving that I released prior to coming into the mayor's office. It's called Stand for Safer Streets. So in order to address reckless driving, what we'll be doing in Milwaukee, what we're currently doing in Milwaukee, is working on safer street design, such as the things you talked about on Van Buren and Water Street that are coming in the future. It means having traffic enforcement that's out there, working with the police department. It means that when folks are caught driving recklessly, that we hold them to account, right? That there's a consequence that they pay. It means working with, you know, our neighbors who feel like prisoners in their own neighborhoods and bringing their voice into the conversation. And then working with, you know, our partners at other levels of government, particularly the state government and the Department of Transportation, because they've got state highways that bisect through the city, such as Capitol Drive, for instance. And demanding progress from them to work with us to move this issue forward so we can reduce issues of reckless driving in Milwaukee. So it's comprehensive. It's an all the above approach that brings in other levels of government, that brings in police, that brings in environmental changes to our infrastructure as well. So it's something I'm very concerned about, something that Milwaukeeans are very concerned about, the number one quality of life issue in the city. And I'm eager to address it.
Our guest is Cavalier Johnson, candidate for Milwaukee mayor in the next Tuesday's runoff election. And if you have questions for him, it's 1-800-642-1234. We will continue with our questions next. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. More than just a name on a building in the city, Frank Zeidler was the mayor of Milwaukee from 1948 until 1960. And Frank Zeidler was the third and last socialist to lead the city. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it was actually Frank's brother, Carl, who unseated Milwaukee's previous socialist mayor, Daniel Hone. Hone was Milwaukee's mayor for 24 years. Carl Zeidler was Milwaukee's mayor for less than two. Carl resigned from office to go fight in World War II, where he is presumed to have gone down with a ship after it was torpedoed by a German U-boat. So with the election for Milwaukee's next mayor a week away, our guest is candidate and current acting mayor, Cavalier Johnson, and he's here to answer your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dana's in Milwaukee this morning. Dana, you're on the air with Chevy.
Hi there. Thank you for having this wonderful program. I really, really appreciate hearing from Acting Mayor Johnson. My question relates to something that I heard Ornell Lucas talk about that I personally agree with, and that's the fact that we have so many cars on the road, and this isn't a reckless driving issue, but we have so many cars on the road speeding down that have no license plates on them, or they have obscured license plates. One day, I counted six, and this is in my mind, anecdotally, this is a big issue. If those are the cars being used to commit the crimes, then like Ornell Lucas says, we need to do something about that sort of more fundamental problem. And do you have plans to address that?
Dana, thank you. Unregistered, unlicensed, and stolen vehicles. Chevy?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a great observation. Quite frankly, when you look at the cars that are driving recklessly in Milwaukee, many times they do fit that description. Although I will say that because we've had this issue where the social norms around driving have deteriorated so much, it's not even just those. Now you got some folks who ordinarily would not take that sort of toll when they're driving in their cars. Now they're willing to do that too. They're willing to take the risk and blow past a stop sign or a stop light, or do the slide around on the right hand side and then go past somebody at excessive rates of speed. So certainly across the board we have the issue that is one of note as well, and one I'd like to see our traffic enforcement to address. The Fire and Police Commission recently adopted one of the strategies that I laid out in my comprehensive plan that I referenced earlier, the Stand for Safer Streets plan, where it calls for the police department in Milwaukee to have the ability to be able to tow vehicles that are driving recklessly. Previously, that power just was not there. Now, when police catch vehicles that are driving recklessly, they'll be able to get those cars, use some new technology to more quickly deploy a tow truck and tow those vehicles and take them off the streets. My thought this whole time has been, if you got folks that are playing a deadly game, then take their toys away, take them out the game. Don't allow them to play it anymore. And that's what police will be able to do in terms of taking their vehicles away. Come May 1st is when that policy will be implemented. And I'd like to see them be more aggressive as well on removing those vehicles off the road, when, especially if they fit that criteria where they're unlicensed, they're unregistered, and they're driving recklessly.
Dana, thank you for the question, and there's still time for yours at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Cavalier Johnson, candidate for Milwaukee mayor in the Tuesday, April 5th runoff election. And as the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner pointed out, the number, a casualty count here is higher than the combined count of homicide, suicide, and motor vehicle deaths in Milwaukee County, and I'm talking about drug overdose last year, 640 of them. What are we going to do about that?
Yeah, that's a terrible statistic for our city and for our county. Most of those drug overdose deaths happen in the city of Milwaukee. Actually, just yesterday, less than 24 hours ago, I joined the fire chief, Aaron Lipsky. I joined advocates out there in our community on the near south side, where if you put a heat map up about where people are facing overdose deaths in our community, we were standing at the epicenter of it. And so we went there and we unveiled these Hope Kits that are now available that folks can just walk up to any fire station and receive that has tools in there to help folks who may see somebody who has succumbed or is succumbing to an overdose to be able to help them to not pass away.
Narcan?
There's Narcan in there. There's CPR masks to help to do that. There are fentanyl test strips because too many people in our community think that they're getting one product, and that product happens to be laced with fentanyl, which, as we know, is extremely deadly in human beings. Just a small amount of that can be deadly for folks. So we just unveiled that just yesterday. And so we're trying to make sure that we keep people alive in Milwaukee. And we hope that those Hope Kits will put us in a position to do just that. In addition to that, I mean, the fire department, our fire department in Milwaukee has done, you know, just an incredible job with its MORI program, the Mobile Overdose Response Initiative, making sure that they address this issue. And with settlement funds that the city has been party to from large opioid pharma companies, it'll present an opportunity for us to be able to adequately fund that program into the future as well. So we continue to address, you know, this issue from these two points, right? From the settlement funds to continue to provide programming through our MORI program, as well as having these Hope Kits available for people throughout the community.
For addicts who are seeking help, assistance, or recovery, is there enough access to those channels in Milwaukee as you see them?
Well, I think, again, for anybody who needs, you know, access, and if they're concerned about, you know, what they're taking, or they have the concern that some of the things that they do take may end up, you know, laced with something like fentanyl, or they may need access to Narcan or something. It's free. You just walk up to any firehouse and you get those services. So there are a number of organizations and individuals out in our city that are concerned about this that would help to direct folks who need that service to the places where they can receive it. But again, you just walk on up to a firehouse in Milwaukee and you're able to get that access for free, no matter who you are.
Cavalier Johnson joining us, and I want to cite your Common Council biography at the City of Milwaukee webpage here. It says, by working together, Cavalier is certain that we can get through the coronavirus health pandemic stronger as a city, while also working to end the plague of systemic racism in our society. How is you can the plague of systemic racism, how can a mayor get a handle on that? What role can you play in dealing with something so big?
Yeah, I think there are a number of ways that we can work on that issue. One, by working to make sure that when the city lets contracts, right, that we're more equitable in the way that we approach it. Another thing is what the city had been going through just recently when we declared racism a public health crisis. We worked with some nonprofits in Milwaukee and made sure that sort of training was available to staff all across the city of Milwaukee. And I believe that every city staff has been able to take that. So that's another. I think another way to do this is to do what I mentioned earlier and what I've been mentioning throughout this campaign, which is providing family-supporting opportunities for the people who live in Milwaukee, creating more prosperity in the lives of the folks that live here so they have more access, you know, in the neighborhoods to be able to move around and not be locked into a particular neighborhood. So we tackle the issue of diversity and make sure that folks have access greater than what they do now. So it's that sort of leadership, I think, that gets us to where we need to go to address this very issue on the inside as well as on the outside.
Chevy, we got about 60 seconds left. So what do people need to know before going to vote next Tuesday?
Well, I again, appreciate the time here this morning with you. I think folks need to know that this is the first time we're electing a new mayor in nearly 20 years in Milwaukee. It's a big deal. It doesn't happen very often, as you guys were accurately pointing out. I think that I've got the skills, the talents, and the passion in order to do this job to make the city safer, first and foremost, but also stronger and more prosperous for everybody that lives here. And the lived experience that I have growing up in the most depressed neighborhoods in Milwaukee gives me the lens in order to do it. It gives me the vision in order to effectuate that change that we desperately need to see in Milwaukee. So I'm hoping that your listeners, especially those in the city of Milwaukee, will vote to elect me if you haven't voted already early, then on Tuesday, April 5th, a perfect week from now.
Hey, Chevy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Cavalier Johnson, candidate for Milwaukee mayor in next Tuesday's runoff election, also the president of the Milwaukee Common Council and a District 2 alder. He became interim mayor of Milwaukee after Tom Barrett resigned. Up next, news. Then we explore how the seven-day week came to be. Let's keep the work week at 5, if you please. Turns out weeks are not dictated by the natural order of things. What would that 7 order of things be anyway? They're actually an artificial construction of our modern society. Who knew? We'll explain after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and fans of Frontline on PBS Wisconsin, don't miss us tomorrow morning after 7 as we talk to the reporter and filmmaker responsible for tonight's new episode, Plot to Overturn the Election. Watch tonight on PBS Wisconsin at 9, then join us as we go behind the scenes tomorrow morning after 7 here on The Morning Show. Now, what makes the week what it is? How did society settle on 7 days anyway? We're exploring these questions, the weekly rhythms of life, on The Morning Show. And the answer, according to one author, lies in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history. David Henkin is an historian at University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. It explores how the 7-day week came to be a cornerstone of our society, no matter where you are. And he recently talked with us about the book and his research. Before we get into the why, David, let's get into why this matters. So from your research, how have you found the 7-day work week affecting us, especially in ways that we might not even realize?
Well, truth is that I was interested not only in the 7-day work week, but all the other things that the week does. And I think that we're attuned to the fact that the 7-day work week gives us a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of rhythm. And that's interesting just because it's sort of become a pretty much a global timekeeping cycle only really in the last century. Century or so. So that's interesting in its own right. But I was especially interested in how it is that even beyond the rhythms of work and not work, the cycle of 7 different days has come to seem so natural to us. It feels like a part of the fabric of our lives, the sort of the anchor of our memory, and all these other things that go beyond simply the separation between labor and leisure. And when I began this book, I didn't know exactly all the things that it did. And I didn't even know exactly how it had come to do those things. But I was convinced that the 7-day week was a technology that performed all kinds of things for us and performed all sorts of things on us as well.
So, and as you write in the week, in contrast to months and years, a 7-day cycle does not form neat fractional subsets of any larger calendar unit. So what makes the week unique then compared to the other ways we keep track of time?
Well, a couple of things. One is not about its uniqueness, but about its independence. In other words, because the week is not a fraction or a portion of a month or a year or a century or a decade or any of that, it kind of is like this separate calendar with its separate history. We might think of it as part of the Gregorian calendar, but it's much older than the Gregorian calendar. It's been observed by many societies that didn't use the Gregorian calendar, and it has its own rhythms that are independent of it. So that's one thing, is that the week is an independent calendar. And the other is the fact that it's not even suggested really by anything in the observable universe means that it is, we know when we think about it, it's not universal, it's not necessary. It's in some ways arbitrary, and many societies have done just fine without that. And then the final thing I would add is because the week is not a portion of or naturally identified with any observable cycle, it means that it's associated with human memory and human record keeping in a pretty unique way. I mean, if we lost track of other units of time, something in our experience would let us know that we had gotten off track. but the week depends entirely on conventions of human scheduling and conventions of human record keeping, which is one of the reasons why we get so upset when we forget what day of the week it is, because we're aware on some level that the week is a vulnerable timekeeping system. It is vulnerable in the same way that human memory is vulnerable.
Wasn't that one of the experiences of the pandemic for just about all of us, though, was the way that days ran together and us stopping to wonder, what is the difference between a Tuesday and a Thursday anyway?
It's a little interesting to me that we focus so much on the week, given the fact that our shutdown experience ought to have confused day and night also, and ought to have confused the times of the year. In some ways, that was a more obvious disruption of our lives. Those of us who were used to spending the day outside the house and the evening inside the house suddenly had spending all time inside the house. And also many annual events like proms or World Series or things like that were affected or postponed by. But instead, we complained about the week, which I took as a sign that we are all very, very much attached to the week above all other calendar units as the anchors of our habits and also the anchors of our experience of memory, which is, I think, what your question was suggesting. Yeah.
So as we're all anchored to this week, but the week seems to be arbitrary, at least in the larger calendar units that we use in the bigger picture of things. So David Henkin, your new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, just how unnatural are these rhythms that we've taken for granted? And in the context of the week, what do you mean with these unnatural rhythms?
Well, by unnatural, I just mean that they're really a sort of a conventional technology for how to divide up time. There are lots of conventional technologies for dividing up time, but most of them are rooted in things like the movements of celestial bodies or the tides or patterns of weather or things of that. The week is not, which is why many parts of the world did not observe a continuous cycle of 7-day increments the way that we do. But now that we do, and now that everyone else does, and now that we use it to organize our lives and schedule our activities, it seems quite natural, right? It seems like today really is, in some sense, a Thursday. And if you think it's not a Thursday, and then you discover it is, it throws you because it feels like you had misunderstood something about the natural world, not just something about your schedule.
It sounds like the rest of our technology is built on this ancient technology that we call the week.
We use many techniques and many machines to track time. The week is a weird one because it is an ancient technology. And so we usually think that modern timekeeping is different from ancient timekeeping in various ways. And the week doesn't fit into any of those distinctions. The week is artificial rather than natural, which is the opposite of what we think. We think of the ancient ones as natural and the modern ones as artificial. The week is cyclical, not linear. We don't think of the artificial ones as being cyclical, but this one is. The week is really a kind of outlier, and I do think of it as an ancient technology.
David Henkin, our guest here on the Ideas Network, he is a historian at the UC Berkeley and also the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. So, David, your book talks about how the week came to be accepted here in the United States. And it's interesting that you juxtapose Cotton Mather and Benjamin Franklin, who both came up with systems for the 7-day cycle. How did the week become so commonplace across so much of this country?
Okay, so I mean, the very simple answer at how the week came to North America is that Europeans and Africans brought it with them. The people who came to North America, either voluntarily or in chains, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, were by and large people who were familiar with the week. In the grand scheme of global history, that they weren't necessarily the majority, but they already understood many of the things that the week can do. And both Benjamin Franklin and Cotton Mather, who both essentially were descended from generations of Puritans, were familiar with a particular use of the week to take stock of one's life, to assess how productive one had been, to measure one's shortcomings, to resolve to do better in the next week. Cotton Mather did so within a very sort of classically Puritan theological framework, having to do with duties toward God. Franklin, who was raised in that culture, but came to embrace other ideas about religion. I used it in a more sort of familiar secular way as a kind of self-help, moral self-improvement, but both of them thought of the week in that way. My point is that the week has done different things for different people, and in 18th century North America, it was already quite familiar to lots of people, both as a system of dividing labor from leisure and as a technology of taking stock. But what I'm interested in the modern world is the way a very different use of the week has come to take over. So in addition to those two and some others, most of us are anchored to the week by schedules. We use the week as a technique for making plans with friends and for scheduling activities with strangers. And in many ways, that's what makes Tuesday and Wednesday so fundamentally different for each of us, is that we have routines, things that we do every 7 days, or sometimes things we do every 14 days or every 28 days, but things that are attached to particular days because of our schedule. And that's something that most people in the United States didn't do in 1800, but that masses of ordinary people in the United States were already doing by about 1850. So in some ways, that is the birth of a particular function of the seven-day week that I think of as its most classically modern feature.
The week is weird. That's historian and author David Henkin, and we'll continue this conversation about the history of the modern seven-day week here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show. Now, let's get back to the evolution of the seven-day week. I recently talked with David Henkin. He's the author of the book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. And here's the second part of that conversation. Let's go back to, for a moment, if we could, the role of imperialism and colonialism and how you see that, David, defining and instilling the seven-day week.
All right, so imperialism and colonialism are powerful forces in the spread of timekeeping technologies. In the case of the week, though, it's a little complex. So for example, European imperial powers impose new calendars on their various colonial territories. Some of those colonial territories already observed the seven-day week. So I'll give you one sort of obvious example. In the Muslim Mediterranean world in North Africa, the imposition of a Gregorian solar calendar onto a Muslim lunar calendar was the occasion for great conflict and confusion and resistance. But the use of the seven-day week was seamless because both of those societies counted a seven-day week and agreed on where we were within the cycle, even if they didn't necessarily use the week for the same purposes. In other places, like in East Asia, military conquest, imperial expansion, and especially the spread of Western capitalism introduced a week in lands that had never counted continuous cycles of 7 days. You'll see a much bigger change for in places like Japan and China, which were not, formally colonized in the same way than you would in places like Egypt or Iraq.
David Henkin, our guest, he is the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. He's a historian at UC Berkeley. And David, how has this week technology, how has this been able to persevere throughout time? How has it been able to, throughout the 19th century and all the other technologies that have developed, how has it persevered?
There are a lot of remarkable things about it. One is that none of the societies that have counted 7 day weeks have ever disagreed about where we are, like what phase of the cycle we're in. And that's a remarkable, given how many conflicts there have been, even within societies about calendars and timekeeping, that the week seems to have created a common ground within and across those societies that have observed it. Maybe the more obvious mystery of the week is how it has survived very powerful and in many ways reasonable attempts to remove it. So I'll give you three examples. These are the three most famous assaults on the weak. One took place in the late 18th century, and it was in the French Revolutionary calendar, which sought to replace the seven-day week with a 10-day, what they called a decade, a 10-day cycle of time. It would be completely independent of, obviously, the seven-day week. That was designed in large part to undermine the power of the Catholic Church in France. Within a few years, it was clear that the French populace was not getting rid of its seven-day week, or for that matter, its weekly patterns of church attendance. The second famous example would be another revolution. So fast forward from the 1790s to the 19-teens and 20s in the Soviet Union, where the Bolsheviks, also interested in undermining the power of an entrenched Christian church, in the case the Russian Orthodox Church, made calendar reforms, serious calendar reforms, many of which were successful. This one was not. What they first tried to do was create a five-day week and then a six-day week. And what they wanted to do was, in some ways, even more radical. They wanted to make a staggered, a non-coordinated week, so that not everyone would have the same day off. This was designed also to create continuous production in Soviet factories, and it too failed after a couple of years. And the seven-day week returned there as well. The third example is less well known, but is at least as interesting, and that is in the capitalist West, led by businesses in the United States, but embraced by reformers in Europe and in North America. There was a plan to just tweak the week in a very small way, not to change its length and not to to break its coordination. In other words, not to stagger it across the population, but just to make it fit into months and especially years. So several companies, most famously the Kodak Corporation, introduced a new calendar for all of its internal purposes. And calendars like that became the model for an international calendar reform movement that sought basically to introduce a 364-day year with extra days at the end. And those extra days, either one or two, depending on whether it was a leap year, would have no place in the weekly cycle.
It's a day without a day of the week?
Exactly. One or two days that are what you might call extra hebdomadal. Right? They stand outside the seven. Now, it's not that weird if you think about it. We do it all the time with holidays. We still call Monday of Labor Day Monday, and the next day is Tuesday. But Monday doesn't feel like a Monday when it's Labor Day, and Tuesday doesn't feel like a Tuesday from the perspective of the work week if it falls after Labor Day. But we still go ahead with our count. But what this calendar reform sought to do was to go from, let's say, Friday, December 31st to a holiday. Mm-hmm. And then the next day would be Saturday, January 1st. And if you did that, then January 1st would be Saturday every year in perpetuity. Huh. So you wouldn't have all these problems. You wouldn't need a new calendar each year. You could organize the months there so they'd have the same number of weeks. Every year would have the same number of working days. It made a lot of sense, and it didn't seem to cause such a problem. I mean, the French Revolution wanted to go to a 10-day week. That was a big change. The Russian Revolution wanted to have people have assigned to different weekly calendars. That's really complicated. All this reform wanted to do was to add one or two days a year that stood outside the week. And there are lots of reasons to think that these reforms would pass, because they were embraced by the same people who were talking about things like having time zones, having international agreement about where the dateline was, moving the clocks forward an hour in the summer and then reverting back in the winter. All these things that we do, right?
Right.
They all succeeded. The one thing that didn't succeed was this reform.
David, so with your research and with your book, The Week, I have to ask, is the concept of the seven-day week becoming obsolete? And if not, should it be?
Well, I think the history of the week in the last 200 years would suggest the opposite, that far from becoming obsolete, it has become universal and much more entrenched. There are some developments in the last 20 to 30 years that might suggest that it's weakening its grip on us. Some of the obvious ones would be things like remote work or synchronized work across the dateline. So all these things that make it less crucial to schedule activities by day of the week and make it less obvious what day of the week it is for all of us. Another one that we sometimes underestimate is the decline of synchronized entertainment. For many people, certainly in my generation and generations prior, the character of each day of the week was shaped by what was on TV, right, or shaped by movies or shaped by radio programming or things of that sort. That is of course no longer the case. We are raising generations of people who consume their entertainment almost entirely asynchronously, with the significant exception of sports. So there are reasons to think that the week is might be less important 20 years from now than it was 20 years ago. And yet it really does seem entrenched. And my research suggests that the week is very, very hard to change and seems almost impossible to extirpate, to uproot. I found no examples of societies that abandoned the seven-day week. And all of our complaining during the pandemic about Blur's Day, you know, the week is this day, that day, the other day, all those things suggest to me that we are far more attached to the week than I would have thought before the pandemic. I would have thought maybe the pandemic would have shown that with our electronic calendars and our asynchronous entertainment and our remote working, that we don't really need the week anymore. That really is kind of an artifact of industrial society, not post-industrial society. But all that complaining that we all did, myself included, about what day of the week it was, suggested to me that it is very, very hard to shake the mental habits that have grown up around the week, both individually and collectively as a society.
David Henkin, thank you for giving us the time to stop and consider the week.
Thank you. Lovely talk to you, Lee.
You know, our seven-day week is just one topic of conversation on the morning show, and I would ask you, this whole team would like to know from you, where would you like us to go next? Where should we go deep and slow down and investigate and dig around? Who would have thought about the seven-day week? We did. And, you know, with your suggestions. So what would you like us to cover and what would you like to weigh in on? Share your conversation ideas with us anytime by visiting WPR.org/mornings. There you can listen to recent discussions, share your ideas for future programs, listen to some old ones, submit a two-question super easy form. You can also send program ideas our way via email anytime at ideas@WPR.org. And thank you for participating. Join us tomorrow morning at 7:30 for the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and hear their warning about our outdated sewage systems. What's happening to our lakes, both great and small, deserve our investigation, and we'll do that tomorrow morning after 7:30 with you. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent today, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.